And so we start off with the P word, or some might say the dark side of public relations, the dark side of journalism. Or maybe it's the purple side. Maybe there's a reason I've actually sort of used a purple slide there to, given that we're in the season of Lent, signify a whole range of other factors. And actually, the reason I mentioned Lent is tying in very much with propaganda, because actually propaganda originates from the Catholic Church, as I'll demonstrate and show in the next few moments. But what else are we actually going to look at? Well, there are things related to, clearly, war, and the First World War, the Second World War, and one of the things that certainly Hitler's friends were very good at was getting their message across. Getting the message across clearly and undeniably. But on the flip side, one could actually argue that it was all through propaganda that we managed to realise as human beings that slavery was a bad thing. So, you know, in terms of the messages that are coming across, as I'll hopefully demonstrate over the next 50 or so minutes, maybe there are pros and cons that need to be considered when we start talking about this thing called propaganda, which even the name itself is highly emotive. It gets to the stage of beginning to, you know, if you're accused of simply peddling propaganda, usually it's not a nice thing. It's something that people react about. It's almost as though you're telling lies about things. Well, even as Warner Brothers have actually demonstrated in their cartoons, maybe there are ways in which messages can be put across in a satirical viewpoint which shares information, which could be classified as propaganda, but at the same time has got other issues that one needs to consider as well. So, as we always like to start off, essays and other things, with respect to definitions, let's consider some of the origins, which is what etymology stands for, the origins of the concept of propaganda. And as you can see, it basically comes across from the 17th century, where clearly in terms of the mission, the spreading the word, the gospel mission, etc., the Congregation for Propagating the Faith was actually established. Again, interesting, we're talking about 1622 here, because we're right at the heart of Henry VIII's rule. We've got a number of other issues that are being developed within that whole field. And there's also something else which is highly significant in terms of media histories that also is responsible for how the Congregation for Propagating the Faith can be developed, how it can really open up a range of elements and so on. And I'll give you a clue. This thing started in 1475. Anybody have any idea what might have happened in 1475? Major thing which had an impact, certainly in terms of the propagating of the faith and so on, and in terms of the way the message was actually disseminated. By the vocal silence, I'll take that as a no. Is he going to pick on some of us? No, I'm not. I'm going to just leave it there. Clearly, the meaning of the word has adjusted, as I said then, a quote from Fellows, because that initial shift in which propaganda was seen as a way of actually transmitting information about the faith of Catholicism, and indirectly, I suppose, Christianity from that point of view, has shifted markedly from the whole notion of the ideological questions of propaganda. The whole notion of actually having particular ideals and concepts that you wish to spread, depending on your concept. If you recall, before Reading Week, a fortnight ago, I was talking about Bernays and Lee and propaganda and ways in which they were using advertising, marketing, to deal with P.T. Barnum, to deal with smoking, to deal with a whole variety of other things and lifestyles. And you could say, well, there's nothing necessarily intrinsically bad about that. It's just marketing. It's just advertising. Is advertising therefore propaganda? Possibly. If it's carrying with it a kind of underlying ideological message and so on, and it's relating to changing people's activities, changing people's behaviour. This is at the heart of what public relations is. It's a way of actually shifting the moods, the framework, coping with different habits. We're slap bang in the middle of a wonderful example vis-a-vis the views and approaches being taken about coronavirus. Has anybody got it yet? In this room? I don't know, please. All sorts of things, challenges put together with respect to that. Mind you, has anybody seen Bethany? Okay, so let's move on. Further definitions, and there, as you can see, I've juxtaposed it with a somewhat satirical image of the author of Mein Kampf, My Struggle, a gentleman who, if only some might say, he had actually been allowed to pursue his career as an artist, which is what he really wanted to do, and hadn't been rejected by two of the fine art studies and colleges of Germany and Austria, maybe he wouldn't have actually then wanted to actually conquer the world, and so on. But nevertheless, in terms of his whole particular sort of aspect, we've clearly got a situation there in which, when it comes to propaganda, not just Hitler himself, but also Goebbels and the Minister of Propaganda, and as we'll see, obviously also the Director of Triumph of the Will, Leni Riefenstahl, very much started promoting this particular message. Abhorrent though it may have been, certainly led to efficiency and a whole variety of other aspects within that. And it's worth thinking about just that middle, that third quote that's actually there. It's one of the few things that, you know, he kind of said, which we still cite, you know, today, and that was obviously 2 years before, a year before World War II, 1938. Is propaganda a means or an end? And his line that it's a means. And how successful propaganda is can only be decided by how successful it actually serves its final objective. What is its final thought as it's looking to develop? Jowett goes on to talk about propaganda as a form of communication that furthers the intent of the propagandist. Everybody has got a message that you want to actually transmit to the masses. How can you do that? Well, you can do it one-on-one and literally speak to every one of the 7 billion people on the planet on a one-to-one basis. That's going to take far too long. You'll be dead before you've actually gone through the first 100,000 or so, presumably. But if you can then use mass media to broaden that range of message, that's when you start developing this whole essence of how do you get those messages across. Also, the final line that I've actually put down there, propaganda doesn't allow for an alternative viewpoint. It's very clear, it's very explicit. Whether it's a case of take back control, as in the case of Brexit, or Arbeit macht frei, as in the case of work gives freedom, as in the case of the concentration camp mottos, it is quite unambiguous in terms of the message that's being put out there. You have to effectively sort of get the message, hence keep it simple, and work through that process. As we said with respect to public relations and Julius Caesar and his early tales of how he would promote his activities in Gaul and the diaries that he would actually put together, we've still, even before Caesar actually came, in the 522 BC, we talked about irrigation last time, about how that was developed, etc. Here we have a situation where there's no objectivities, it's quite simply an inscription that's put together proclaiming the awesomeness, and indeed you can tell he's awesome, because you wouldn't necessarily have the great after your name if you weren't really awesome. So the very name itself, Darius the Great, is not Darius the partially okay or Darius the reasonably fair. It's Darius the Great. Three languages, and again, this is something that we actually see in the cities of Babylon, Ecbatana, and so on. Those Sumerian cities, etc. So it goes back a long, long way, but there was something, I come back to this 1475 thing, what actually happened that kind of triggered in terms of our contemporary Western world, the media history. And there it is, okay? 1475, yeah, started investigating 1440, started developing in that. And it's a gentleman who actually had had several careers before he actually hit on this notion of printing. He'd actually looked to develop medicines, fake medicines, quack medicines, quack medical cures, which didn't necessarily work. He tried a number of other sorts of areas. And finally, Johannes Gutenberg thought, actually, what about this thing called printing? What about actually if we can put together mass scenarios here? And ultimately, you know, literally within 50, 60 years after the printing press was developed, It enabled Luther, Martin Luther, to put his alternative message and viewpoint across. It enabled Henry VIII to put together his Fide Defensor. And in mass producing things which previously were laboriously produced by hand on scrolls on parchment. Obviously there was writing before the printing press was invented. But that whole notion of mass producing things certainly really didn't open itself up until the back end of the 15th century, which led, as I say, to characters like Thomas Paine proclaiming the rights of man and indirectly being responsible for the American War of Independence and the success of that. And, clearly, from a journalistic perspective, the whole fact that the newspaper becomes in itself a mass media form. It's a way of communicating with large numbers of people. Thousands, hundreds, billion, etc., etc. So is it a good thing? Are there times where you can actually look through that? And that's the reason I thought I'd bring in Josiah Wedgwood as an example. As I said, relatively short-lived life, I suppose you'd say, 65 years, so you know, too young, so mid-range from that point of view. He was quite clearly against slavery. He was an abolitionist. But how could he get his message across? How could he actually sort of stress the notion that actually, as you can see there in the inscription, am I not a man and a brother? You know, how do you develop that? Well, his line, in a form of propaganda which you could say was very much a PR stunt, was he actually commissioned and produced a medallion, which effectively also meant the people who wore that medallion, it's a bit like the pink ribbon that we can wear, or the other sort of aspects that kind of show support, a visible sign of that support. And it was quite clearly propaganda that was being used because it didn't basically permit any alternative viewpoint, but it was getting the message across that slavery as an institution, which is what it was and had been since the ancient Greeks, was fundamentally flawed. And it was wrong to actually, you know, engage in the process, and still is, obviously, even though there are cases of modern-day slavery, etc. And clearly that whole notion of how the thing developed, how it evolved and so on, tied in with this whole essence of maybe there are cases where you can use propaganda to promote a cause which is essentially just. Although, again, you know, the alternative viewpoint, how do you actually discuss that? Again, that's for further discussions, etc. Still sticking with the slavery sort of issues. It's interesting that abolitionists, as I said in that quote there from Stamp, there was never any case that effectively images of seeing the ill treatment of slaves actually really impacted hugely on people's opinions. It was quite clearly a notion of how this message was put together, and as you can see in the somewhat disturbing image that we see there in the 19th century of a human being who's been viciously sort of whipped on his back, etc., from that point of view. It raises that whole process of how the message needs to be put across. Propaganda sometimes actually will use shocking images, shock tactics, to get its point across. As we say, the notion of the pornography of pain is used as an example of how that can be impactful. It's almost like looking at worst-case scenario, but actually, in so many senses of the word, you also open up the kind of messages that are there as well. And if you're producing the sort of messages from that, clearly there is a fundamental message that actually this is wrong. Maybe compare it with the point of view of some of the activities that are going on from climate change people, Extinction Rebellion folk, and so on. I mean, we hear today that Chris Packham has taken a legal challenge the government's HS2 route and so on. Again, lots of messages coming across there, and lots of counter messages as well from that point of view. This is one of the things where, because of propaganda, it polarises. It provides distinct opposites. You're either for something or you're against it. There's no real middle ground. You can't say, well, I'm a little bit in favour of abolishing slavery. But, you know, you either are or you aren't. It's very much a sort of classic line from there. This is where we see the development, though, in this particular instance, of how mass media and a story can fulfill what we would refer to as propaganda. Because you're telling that story through the mass media. Public relations is all about stories. Therefore, propaganda is all about stories. How those messages are put out there open up the range of how we are informed and what decisions we actually make. And there is a heck of a good story. The Great War, as it was first built, 1914 to 1918, 106 years ago now since it kicked off with the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, and so on. And clearly you have two particular strategies actually there. First of all, Lord Kitchener, real person on the left-hand side, with the equivalent of something which is still used even now. In fact, I'm amazed I didn't really see an equivalent in the recent tranche of student elections, because normally there's at least one candidate that uses something along those sort of lines. But, you know, Britain's country needs you, join your country's army, God save the king, very much appealing to patriotism, etc. There are a number of other examples I'll show you in a few moments which are even more directly targeted at people's individual beliefs, etc. And then latterly, of course, following the same model, because remember the United States didn't actually enter the First World War until 1917, the fictitious figure of Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam representing everything that is American, really. This new, bright, sparky nation that had effectively kicked out the British and then effectively itself almost ripped itself to shreds between 1861 and 1865 through the American Civil War, of course, tying in with slavery. But in this unifying thing, and it's often said that it was actually, there's never been a specific time, but most historians would say it's around about 1870, 1875, various kind of fates where there was an attempt to unify the United States. And the character of Uncle Sam seems to have emerged then as somebody who would effectively take on board that spirit of the country, much as you could say Father Christmas takes on board the spirit of Christmas and so on, the Easter rabbit, the spirit, etc., etc. But that whole notion of Uncle Sam being seen within that whole thing. And obviously, if Uncle Sam is saying he wants you, emphasise, look at the way the structure is actually composed, for the United States Army, you know, there's a notion that you're going to be developed within that whole field. As I said, one of the things that we were way ahead of in some ways before Bernays and Ivy Lee and so on started using their psychological approaches in the States was in how we actually use very sophisticated, well-known, very popular, keyword, popular writers to effectively promote the government's point of view. I would hope that most of you in the room have actually heard of Arthur Conan Doyle. What did he write? Exactly, and a variety of other sort of stories about by Thomas Hardy, Tess of the D'Urbervilles, Far from the Madding Crowd, Rudyard Kipling, Jungle Book, If. I mean, Kipling, of course, if you recall, I think Journalism Histories, Kipling, of course, went through a particular period in which pre the Great War, pre World War I, he was very much a patriotic individual, maintained solid belief in the British Empire. Following the death of his son in the First World War, he became much more bitter and was very much concerned about his life from that. And Herbert George Wells. Anybody name any of the wonderful classics that H.G. Wells produced? Caroline?
I was going to say War of the Worlds.
You would be right, absolutely. War of the Worlds, The Time Machine, The Invisible Man, Island of Dr. Moreau, Things to Come, one of the fathers of modern day science fiction. But again, you've got, in essence, there four names that actually were there who were all high. I mean, these were not just hacks. These were not people who effectively were untried, who were basically sort of given a thing to actually write. You know, these were sophisticated, proven, published writers who knew the power of the word, knew the kind of way in which you could actually carve words to have meaning and develop things from that point of view, and in particular, promote the viewpoint. Go back to the propagation of the faith, propaganda, promoting the viewpoint, etc. If you then actually add to the notion of having lots of artists who will develop graphic images of what's happening at home, what's seen on the battle lines, etc., you have a range of other factors. And then finally, of course, we have, actually, it's 1918, the year there, I just realised there's a typo there, Lord Beaverbrook became Minister of Information. Now, what does that actually entail? Well, let's look at Beaverbrook's own words. When Beaverbrook founded the Daily Express, you know, 100 or so years ago, he was quite clear that he wanted it as a newspaper, a mass-produced newspaper, which would basically enable him to pursue his political ambitions. Fantastic. You know, why not? You know, produce a paper, promote it. I mean, after all, Donald Trump used The Apprentice, similar sort of things. He's president of the United States. Genius. You know, the more you kind of seen, the more you get sort of focused on Boris Johnson and have I got news for you, blah, 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 etc. All connected within that. And Beaverbrook, as he said himself, he was setting up a propaganda paper. But he was also aware of one of the crucial rules of propaganda. If it's going to be successful, or if the propaganda is going to be effective, the paper has to sell. It has to be popular. If you only have, I don't know, a circulation of 50 or 60, compared with a paper that sells 50,000 to 60,000, which one's going to get the biggest message across? You know, clearly, it's the more numbers you can get there. Something which, again, in terms of comparative media histories, we go back to. Remember the line I said about commercial radio, commercial broadcasting, in the business of delivering audiences to advertisers. You know, another form of advertising, another form. The more popular, the more successful, the more you can get that message across from that point of view. And again, high circulation, advertising, promoting it. People start trusting your viewpoint. You start beginning to actually build that relationship with your readership, who will then come on board and say, ah, yes, fine, well, if it says it in the Express, it must be true. And if you see posters like that around, maybe it'll work through a whole range of other aspects from a psychological viewpoint. I don't know if you can actually see that. Hopefully you can actually see the sort of notion that there we have a wonderful, tranquil scene, traditional white Anglo-Saxon Protestant line there, two children, well, presumably his children, because we're referring to that, little boy playing with his soldiers there, little soldier thing from that point of view. And of course, what do we get? Daddy, what did you do in the Great War? It's clearly making an emotional play on, if you haven't got involved with the Great War, are you really a proper father? How are you going to relate to your children when they ask that kind of question? How are they going to connect on that basis, etc.? Slightly different, but nonetheless sufficiently emotive. Destroy this mad brute. Enlist. Wonderful classic image there. You much beloved of Pulp Fiction writing and so on, of the damsel in distress and this huge bestial character with, of course, the classic Kaiser Bill helmet on as well, and the club that's actually there in terms of the Kultur sort of club that's actually around from that point of view. Surely, if you're a man, you know, how do we try that? If you're a man, you've got to take part in this whole side of things from that point of view. And obviously, again, this is the more sophisticated notion, the report of the committee on alleged German outrages. Alleged German outrages. What is actually happening? What's being done? You know, the line, the first casualty of war is the truth. You see this on both sides. You know, Britain is not unique in this. It's not, sadly, the last sort of person to actually use it, but it's still very much tapping into those things that basically outrages. You know, surely anybody is going to be annoyed about this. How can you let this happen to Belgium? How can you let this happen to us? To whatever, etc., etc. Now, it's still, on one level, plugging into the same sort of approaches that our slavery medallion was plugging into. We've got to end this, we've got to approach this, and so on. But it's still making, again, some interesting political points. stories of what German atrocities that you actually get there. You know, in this particular instance, the assassination of Miss Edith Cavell. You may, I mean, again, Google, by all means do so. You'll find a wonderful story of the first female spy, Edith Cavell, a nurse. She was assassinated, not quite in the leg of the Mata Hari, etc. But again, how could this nurse, you know, played, you know, obviously the movie made after, could be assassinated? And this is après l'exécution, you know, after the assassination, etc., just making sure that she's completely dead on that basis. You know, you're killing a nurse. A nurse is being killed. You know, terrible. And of course it is. But how do those messages get out of that? And what is the import? What is the intent from this point of view? Giant Cunarder, crowded with passengers, callously sunk without warning off the Irish coast. The Lusitania torpedoed by a German pirate. Now, draw that and compare it with 9/11 and see the kind of notions that were being plugged in terms of the start of this century with respect to the terrorist atrocities, etc. Again, problems with that. But see again the kind of language, the kind of approaches that are being made. You'll see the contemporary and the kind of historical aspects. And maybe in 100 or so years, maybe we haven't progressed as much as we think we have. Likewise, number of sort of key things that you get. I mean, obviously, very important, because what self-respecting individual wouldn't actually want to have their purchase of cigarettes, etc. The line of how the next to be kicked out, you know, kick out the Germans from heaven and so on. Here we have, you know, the Schweinhund, etc. You know, eating again, the helpless citizens from that sort of point of view, and so on. Again, demonize, bestialize. You know, start separating the enemy, us and them. See them as being demonic and so on. And you could even use humour as well. The sad experiences of Big and Little Willie, Kaiser Bill, of course, Kaiser William, and his commandants during the first 6 months of the Great War, as portrayed by W.K. Hasselden in the Daily Mirror, etc. So a number of key things there. These were two characters who became extremely popular in terms of obviously showing the ineptitude and the foolishness of the enemy and so on. So, I refer to perhaps demonising themselves there, the Yanks. No, I should just keep it as the Americans. But clearly this was highly successful in the First World War, in the Great War as it was known. It was a highly successful way of actually approaching the way in which enemies could be demonised. It improved recruitment rates substantially. And it was interesting that both Bernays and another expert on propaganda, Walter Lippmann, was very keen to develop this whole approach and started using this quite extensively in America as a way to actually develop particular areas. They refer to it as a four-minute man, attention spans. You know, it's the old line that most undergraduates, most psychologists would say have an attention span about 5 minutes, so on that basis most of you tuned out, you know, quite frequently during the periods I've said so far, so you're endorsing it, you're making notes and so on. But again, it's a way in which you're getting messages across. It's a way in which you're selecting what are the key things to be put together. You know, if you're moving to a more state-controlled environment, then maybe you need to promote that. If you're moving towards different sort of aspects in society, again, you need to work through processes about that, whether you want to become more involved with Europe and the world, less involved with Europe and the world, and so on. The other critical thing that's here, of course, is something which, again, I spoke about a couple of weeks ago. The huge phenomenon of the other mass media, cinema. A couple of links there, but if they do, and again, you can look at Birth of the Nation, Battle of the Somme, etc. All ways in which moving images can provide to an audience certain narratives, certain stories. They do this in the same way as actually having the notion of giving a narrative to a story, framing it, using the kind of techniques that we now see as a matter of course within selection, editing, choosing which are the right images to portray and how those things can be put into form, etc. And between 1918 to 1938, gradually we see propaganda effectively being seen as quite a good thing, really. And actually, you know, it's seen from that point of view. I'll give you a few seconds to read that line by Bernays. And, you know, when you actually read what he's saying there, what's wrong with that? You know, I mean, it's basically sort of saying that in a democratic society. What's not to love about democracy? You know, rule people by the people, etc. You need to effectively coordinate that democracy. You need to gradually suggest what are the right things to do. You need to have some sort of ways. You can't let people do all their own things, otherwise you'll have anarchy there. And it's interesting that from his viewpoint there, is he talks about it being unseen. If propaganda is good, you don't know it. It's almost invisible. You don't really, you know, it's when you start realising you're being manipulated, then propaganda arguably isn't doing its job. And that's one of the reasons why education can be quite a dangerous game player in these days, where you actually start saying, don't think about things, just do them, just react. You know, you don't want to be actually asking the question why. Might have been good enough for Socrates, but, you know, not for the present system, etc. And again, Bernays' line there, that the people who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government. So is it Dominic Cumming? Is it actually Steve Bannon? Is it the people behind the people who effectively are put up as the initial individuals who ultimately say, this is the line we're going to take? Was it Alistair Campbell in the case of the press secretary when he was in Tony Blair's government and so on? How are we seeing that particular aspects developed? And it almost becomes part of parcel of an institutional aspect. That's called the Ministry of Propaganda. Again, it's interesting that Britain changed it to the Ministry of Information. What's the difference between propaganda and information? The Crown Film Unit pretty much stayed the same, but it was a change in terms of the name and a change in emphasis, etc. Now, also in the 30s, whilst Bernays is talking about the importance of propaganda in a coherent, well-built society, there you can see what are the key areas that are being developed in Germany. Obviously, having been at the negative end of propaganda, this is a real chance for them to actually get a front step on the whole system. And as you can see there, Goebbels learns from the best, decides to actually take some of the things and images that Britain have actually used and applies them. He applies them to demonise the Jews, to demonise other less Aryan life forms that are actually there. And also making sure that you're on message, that you ensure that all writers, artists, journalists, etc., whatever medium you're working in, whether it's fine arts, the press, radio, film, theatre, you need to be on message. Otherwise, you might be producing something which is seen as bourgeois and effectively unclean. Now, arguably, this is also taking place, arguably it is taking place, in the Soviet Union as well. Still does in China, in other societies, and societies which basically only want to have one message. It's interesting that the doctor who was effectively seen as the whistleblower for the coronavirus suddenly ends up dead within a few weeks, etc. All sorts of other areas there which you can dig a little bit into and maybe find out some interesting sort of factors about how these things are being portrayed, provided, and so on. That quote there, I mentioned about Soviet Union. Lenin, of course, who together with Stalin were the sort of early leaders of the Union for Soviet Socialist Republics, really significant. I mean, it's not to say that Eisenstein and some cinema directors within the Soviet Union were uninfluential. Clearly they were. But the huge popularity of the moving image, the cinema, Hollywood, etc., was very much part of it. Even our very own Jane Chapman herself basically sort of used that quote there, which I thought was worth putting in there. Cinema fiction manipulating emotions and feelings as part of the war effort. Something which is worth it. Again, either of those two, have a look at them, you'll find them quite shocking in terms of the way, in the blatant sort of way in which both Leni Riefenstahl portrays the supreme nature of the German Aryan character. And, of course, the way in which the Jew in particular is demonised within that. This is also echoed in terms of Hollywood, but it's taken a different line from that point of view. And some of these classic movies, in the case of Casablanca, The Great Dictator, also echo that. Consider what we'll see in Chaplin's The Great Dictator, in terms of how, again, humour is used, again, to start demonising, in this particular instance, obviously, Germany, before America has even entered the Second World War.